or not? Is there any guarantee or not? Because these people are looking for a guarantee for love after marriage.
But of course, nothing in life has guarantee.
Nothing has guarantee. So the first point is that not all the people, we are not against the concept of love. We have so many narrations about the concept of love in our books of narrations, and the ways that the wife and husband needs to express their love toward each other, toward their children, and so on and so forth. But my point is that there is no guarantee that those people who love, I mean, as boyfriend and girlfriend, they love each other, and then they get married, but they remained as loving each other after marriage. There is no guarantee, and I think statistics tell us that in many cases also they ended up in divorce as well.
Exactly.
Even people who loved each other before getting married. So it's not a way to undermine the Islamic laws to just say that there is no guarantee. There is no guarantee even for BFGF, relations as well after marriage. The second question is that if we may think of two options, a marriage based on cognition and knowledge and a marriage based on love, which one is preferred? According to the religion of Islam, first and foremost, marriage should be based on understanding and logic and recognizing each other. Of course, love matters, but before that, what matters the most is to know each other.
The person himself or herself.
But unfortunately, what matters in boyfriend and girlfriend relations is that they love each other and they do not see the faults and the deficiencies. And that is why when they get married, they live together. Just then they come to know the realities of each other.
They don't look beyond the person who they are seeing right now.
That's the point. So Islam says that before getting married, go to know each other. And there are many ways. Islam is not, promoting the idea of getting married with blind eyes and with a boy and a girl that do not know anything about that. No,
they have no idea about each other.
Yeah, in the past we have some so-called traditional families who may have done so. But this is not the Islamic way of getting married.
Exactly, it was tradition. It wasn't about the
religion. It was a
tradition,
and maybe some people thought that this is Islamic, but this is not Islamic. Mm-hmm. This is anti-Islamic. So before marriage, you need to know each other. But does it necessarily mean that this knowledge should be through boyfriend-girlfriend relation? Islam says that no, you can know each other through some ways. One way can be, for example, talking to each other, but the families know about.
They are all aware of what's going on.
They all are aware of that. So when it is done under the control of the families, it means that
no one would get hurt.
Exactly. And all these bad stories that we hear, none of them will happen. So through these dialogue sessions, if you may call it dialogue sessions, boys and girls, they come to know each other. Without touching, of course, they are non-mahram to each other.
They would get the headlines about each
exactly.
other.
Exactly. And they will come to this understanding whether they can match each other or not. And through that, love may happen too. So if they come to this understanding that they match each other, love can happen before marriage too. Mm-hmm.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So my point is that Islam emphasizes on knowing each other before marriage and not on
just love,
which according to these people requires relation, without being mahram to each other. Islam is against that. Islam is against such relations which are done without the fathers and the parents.
And I guess it's for the benefit of those people. It has been said that way for the benefit of the girl, mostly girls and also boys, because no one would get heartbroken.
Exactly. That's the point. And even another solution for some people, it may help. Some Muslim families also, they try that. And that is the concept of temporary marriage that we have it in Islam. Of course, I mean, our Sunni brothers believe that it is only a Shia concept, but we believe that it's in an Islamic. But anyway, for some families, they say that, okay, this boy and girl, they want to know more each other. And we do not want them to fall in committing sins. So they can be mahram to each other for a couple of weeks, for example, for a couple of months, through this concept of contemporary marriage. So even they may, for example, touch each other, but within the limits, but through that they may come to a kind of more understanding. So this is, of course, this is not suggested for all the people. For some families, they may think that if they recite the contract of temporary marriage, it can help the boy and the girl not to commit any sin. And after, of course, it shouldn't be too long.
All exactly, the scholars, they that's the point. Should,
because some people go through this relation for a couple of years, and then, so I mean, you do not need so much time to come to know each other, to be realistic.
It doesn't take that long to know a person.
And at the end of the day, you will not know each other
exactly
before
going under
the
same roof.
Exactly, this is a reality. But anyway, this is a solution for some people who want to know each other more and maybe to be away from any kind of sin, but more practically maybe to, talk to each other, but with the control of the families.
Within
limits. It helps a lot. The next point is that, as I mentioned, Islam is a pro-love religion, and we have so many narrations in this regard. Islam, especially when it comes to the men, I mean the husbands, encourages them a lot to express their love toward their wives. So we shouldn't think that, okay, this is, Islam is a religion which is against the concept of love. No, this is not the reality. In one tradition, one of the infallible says that, قول الرجل لمراته, if a man tells his wife that I love you, it will not be removed from her heart at all. So Islam emphasizes on the concept of love.
But after marriage.
After marriage, of course. This is one point. And the second point is that love has some, levels. So I believe that if a marriage is based on knowledge, which Islam emphasizes on a lot, then love happens naturally speaking too. Especially if we take into consideration the Islamic advices in this regard. Like for example, saying your feelings, like buying gifts, and so on and so forth. So if a life of the spouses are based on Islamic laws, and before that the marriage is based on knowing each other, on recognition, on cognition and knowledge, I believe that love will also be there, gradually speaking. And of course, no one can say that this is love and this is not love. Mm-hmm. It has levels, it has stages. So, and of course we need to also say that there are some practical ways for increasing our love. There are some practical ways. For example, in this case, we have some narrations and we have some advices by the psychologists, for example. We need to spend time if we want to have a life based on love. We need to be together,
it takes time to buy a heart.
Exactly, that's the point. And to express your love is very important, especially for men out there. Many of them, they are not ready to express their love. Of course, deep in their heart, they love. But Islam says that, no, it's not enough. Just express your love.
You have to show
it. Women like to hear that from you.
Mm-hmm.
So to put it in a nutshell, we mentioned that this question somehow is trying to mention that Islam is against the concept of love, and the marriage based on love is guaranteed, but Islam says that there is no way to love each other before marriage. We said that, first of all, is there any guarantee that boyfriends and girlfriends who love each other
end up happily,
end up in having a long life with love? No, in many cases, it doesn't continue.
They
like
fall
that.
Into a divorce.
Yeah, and we said that Islam puts emphasis on marriage based on knowing each other, and we believe that a marriage based on knowing is much better than a marriage which is only based on love.
Mm-hmm.
Without knowing each other. And Islam has many ways for knowing each other, like, as we said, talking under the control of the families and the parents, and in some cases maybe being mahram for for a short time. And third, we said that when you get married, Islam has so many ways for advancing love among the spouses, like expressing, like buying gifts, and so on and so forth.
So, as we see, Islam is not against love, but what happens is that it is against forbidden relationships,
exactly.
Which is going to hurt both sides, the girls and the boys. After all, I would say thank you for listening. This was all the time that we had for today. Until another session, I bid you farewell, and I leave you to the protection of God.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Country of nearly 10 million people, Sweden is usually referred to as a utopian society, mainly for its cradle-to-grave welfare state. Politicians like Bernie Sanders and Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez have heaped praise on Sweden as the political system of their dreams. Yet this Swedish model is uglier than it might appear to be. As Swedish stand-up comedian Magnus Bettner once said, we're a nation of beautiful people singing happy songs in stylish modernist apartments. But that's not how we Swedes see ourselves. We have a very, very dark side, and I think you're only just finding out about it now. For more than a century, Swedes from Alfred Nobel to teen climate activist Greta Thunberg have been lecturing the world on peace, justice and progress while turning a blind eye to the more disturbing elements of their own history. Swedes suppress the memory of their nation's long-standing slave trade as one of the pillars of their economy. The country was also a major supplier of iron chains used in the slave trade. The Swedes traded slaves up to the mid-19th century. During most of World War II, the Swedes had a willing collaboration with Nazi Germany, even while technically maintaining neutrality. In the words of Elisabeth Asbrink, Sweden managed to maneuver itself through the war without officially taking sides, so all the people in Sweden who wanted Hitler to win, and there were many of them, never had to deal with the consequences of the stigma that collaborators in the occupied countries received. They also don't discuss the 63,000 of their fellow citizens who were forcibly sterilized right up until 1976 to keep the welfare system free of children who might inherit mental or physical disabilities. In fact, Sweden has never been an ideal place for women. The country's rape statistics are among the highest in Europe. In Sweden, almost every second, a woman reports lifetime exposure to some kind of serious violence, of which 65% is sexual harassment and 20% is sexual violence.
As a woman, you know that these things happen, but that what was overwhelming was that it was so common, and especially the testimonies from the cultural sector, from artists, from actresses. I feel quite encouraged and empowered by all these testimonies from different sectors of the Swedish society, that the tolerance on sexual harassment is really over now.
Rape survivors in Sweden continue to face barriers in accessing justice, and few investigations have led to prosecution and conviction. Moreover, Sweden is a destination country for women trafficked from countries such as Romania, Russia, and Nigeria for the purpose of commercial sexual exploitation. Meanwhile, around 25,500 cases of abuse against children below 18 years of age were reported to the Swedish authorities in 2020. A 2006 report released by Global Monetary on the commercial sexual exploitation of children found systemic faults in Sweden, including allowing child pornography to be viewed and failing to care properly for children caught up in sex trafficking.
The sexual exploitation of vulnerable people, vulnerable children, is never acceptable. But when it is perpetrated by people in positions of power, people we entrust to help and protect, it rightly sickens and disgusts, and it should compel us to take action.
A steep increase in immigration since 2011 has tested the limits of Swedish generosity. Back in November 2021, Stockholm abandoned its heroic rhetoric of welcoming refugees just to adopt the harsh language only far-right nativists of the Sweden Democrats Party used in 2015. Sweden now forcibly returns asylum seekers despite the worsening security situation in the country of origin.
Really, I don't know, because yesterday I seen the TV and the internet. This is, I think this is not really, because this is writing this 80,000 people this go back to the country. But which people, which country, I don't know. And I think this is only speak.
On the other hand, racism is blighting Swedish society, and people of African descent face daily harassment and hate crimes. The anti-immigration, anti-Islam Sweden Democrats is now the largest party in southern Sweden and the third largest party in the Swedish parliament. According to the UN Working Group of Experts of People of African Descent, a real fear within the communities, especially for young black men, is that they could be violently attacked at any time. As a result of structural racism, black people in Sweden have reduced access to healthcare and education, while the police view them as criminals rather than a vulnerable community that needs protection. While Sweden is no longer open to the desperate people coming from war-stricken countries, it is still a safe haven for the Mujahedin Khalq organization, the MKO, a terrorist group which has assassinated tens of thousands of Iranian citizens since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Meanwhile, over the last 20 years, Sweden has gone from having one of the lowest to one of the highest levels of gun violence in Europe, worse than Italy or Eastern Europe. The increase in gun homicide in Sweden is closely linked to criminal melee in socially disadvantaged areas. Swedish Minister of Finance Magdalena Andersson boasted last year that her Swedish Social Democratic Party added 7,000 new police officers, built more prisons, and drafted laws creating 30 new crimes. In the land of generous welfare, the Roma people, primarily citizens of Romania and Bulgaria, continue to face discriminatory treatment, with many sleeping in tents or temporary settlements on the outskirts of the cities. Surprisingly enough, Stockholm has failed to recognize its own indigenous Sami people's rights.
The Swedish government needs to stop the colonization of Sápmi. We believe that the climate, the environment, clean air, water, reindeer herding, indigenous rights and the future of humanity should be prioritized before and above the short-term profit of a company, a British mining company.
The major preacher of human rights has been selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates since 1998, with most of the sales over the past decade. That's while the two Arab countries have been involved since 2015 in a bloody war against Yemen. There is no sign of a slowdown in this arms sales relationship. Sweden's arms manufacturer Saab opened an office in Abu Dhabi in 2017. The question is, how can Sweden be a peace broker if it's also selling the arms that make the war in Yemen possible? By and large, Sweden is using its undeserved benevolent reputation as a mask for serious violations of human rights on its soil.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's tip: what are the tricks of Shaitan, the Satan, and the soul? And when it comes to our ubudiyah, how do they infiltrate?
Allah, Allah, Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear listeners, we are talking about the tricks and the delusions and the deceptions of Shaitan and ourself, and how it impacts and affects our ubudiyah, our servitude, our obedience, and our worship to Allah. Now, what is really interesting is that the things which are possible for the common people to do, whether it's in our prayers or our worship or these things, these common things that, for example, for the common people seem to be very simple, such as the salah, the daily prayers, for the people of knowledge, the Ahl al-Ma'rifah, it actually becomes a delight. It is one of the most satisfying and pleasurable things and actions, the salah, the daily prayers. Now, because these things which to common people seem to be common, such as the du'as and the supplications and the litanies and the different types of worship and obedience and ubudiyah to Allah, in reality, these are the secrets and the keys to spiritual wayfaring. Now, when it comes to the spiritual wayfaring, the salik, the spiritual wayfarer who is on this road to ubudiyah, must be very careful that when it comes to their knowledge or when it comes to the different manasik, the different rites and rituals, such as the daily prayers or the du'as that are prescribed by the Ahlul Bayt, when the salik and the spiritual wayfarer is doing these things, they should be very careful that the deceptions and the tricks of Shaitan
and the nafse amara do not interfere in these actions that they are doing when it comes to the ubudiyah of Allah. Now, of course, this kind of protection and being careful of the intrusions and the deceptions of shaitan and the nafse amara, this takes a lot of focus, it takes attention, it takes meditation, it takes time, it takes practice, it takes determination, and it takes, of course, as we said, self-reflection. One needs to contemplate on their intention, on their niyyah, and they need to go and reflect deeply into what they do, what their desires are, what their mission is, what their goal is, what their ultimate objective is in this journey, in this journey of the ubudiyah of Allah. Also, one needs to be strict with oneself. One needs to examine oneself and to learn the basic principles of the activities of the soul, and also pay attention to spiritual nutrition. Now, activities and different aspects of the soul, different qualities, if we could say, you know, such as anger or greed or jealousy or desire, these things need to be examined very carefully. And of course, the salah and the du'as that have been prescribed are spiritual nutrition. And so in these few ways, we are able to protect ourselves from the intrusions and the deceptions of shaitan and the nafse ammara in order to be able to strengthen and purify our ubudiyyah.
Ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah, ya
Manan, IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, ya Rahman, haqqiq amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. Ya Allah, ya Manan, haqqiq amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير، أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
Allah is the unique Arabic name for the one true God. He is the only one worthy of worship, with no rivals, equals, or partners. Allah is not like His creation, as nothing shares His divine essence and attributes, such as being the Creator, the Provider, the Most Merciful, the All-Powerful, the Most Just, the All-Wise, and the All-Knowing. Allah is without partner or equal in His authority and actions. The world was created by Allah's command alone. He runs the world and controls it all alone. Muslims believe that Allah is one, indivisible, and unequal in His divinity and knowledge. He does not have any ancestors, nor does He have descendants, and He is without wife, partner, or offspring. None came before Him, and He is in no need of any angel, prophet, or saint. Of all the sins committed by His creation, none is greater than the act of shirk, which is the Arabic word for associating partners with Allah. In the Islamic tradition, Allah has 99 names, which include the most loving, the friend, the most kind, and the most powerful. Allah can be translated in English language as the one and only God.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were speaking about, which was how to protect ourselves from the effects of the intrusions and the deceptions of shaitan and the nafs-e ammara when it comes to our ubudiyya, and of course the effects that this intrusion has upon our ubudiyya. Now, of course, when talking about the effects of the intrusions and deceptions of shaitan and the nafs-e ammara, of course we find that our ubudiyya, our worship, our du'as, they are no longer as sincere as they used to be. They are no longer as, they don't bring about the bliss and satisfaction that they used to, or they become tainted and corrupted. And of course, the intended consequence, which is the ultimate perfection of a human being, is not achieved. Of course, why? Because of the deceptions and the intrusions of shaitan and the nafs-e ammara. In the previous segment, we talked a little bit about how we need to protect ourselves by examining within ourselves, self-reflection, contemplation, meditation, and of course, spiritual nutrition, such as the daily prayers, such as the du'as prescribed by the Ahlul Bayt. Another one of the things that we should do is to kind of distrust what we are doing in our activities and our ubudiyya, meaning always check ourselves. Are we really doing a certain action for the pure sake of ubudiyya? This is what is meant by distrusting yourself when it comes to your activities. So for example, you're giving charity. At the very superficial level, you might think that you are doing it for the sake of Allah. But when you think about it a little bit deeply, and you kind of double-check yourself, you cross-examine yourself, then you might realize that I was doing it to show off to other people, and perhaps even more subconsciously and more in a subtle manner. We might just be doing it to show it to the person that we are giving the charity to. And so it is quite possible, dear friends, that because of a little bit of negligence and not paying attention, this kind of ulterior motive, this tainted niyyah, may overcome a human being and knock them down and drive them towards perdition and annihilation. When one realizes that the actions that they did for ubudiyya and the actions that they did in ubudiyya for the sake of Allah were not done purely for the sake of Allah, then truly we have lost both in this world and the hereafter. And when we do realize that perhaps in the actions that we committed in the past there was an ulterior motive, we ask Allah the Almighty, who is the most merciful and the most quick to forgive, we ask Him to forgive us and to make up for the faults and the flaws and the shortcomings in our ubudiyya and our worship. And so therefore we must try our best to make sure that the intrusions and the deceptions and the tricks of shaitan and the nafs-e ammara, the base carnal soul, we protect ourselves from these deceptions and these tricks so that we can purify and strengthen our ubudiyya, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website, www.parstoday.com.
And now we invite you to listen to Brother Nu'man Ali Khan.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. فدلاهما بغرور رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي امري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. The 22nd ayah of Surah Al-A'raf is a long one, but in this brief reminder I want to share with you the first part of the expression that's used in it that has just an incredible amount of wisdom for life in our dealings with shaitan. Allah Azza wa Jalla is describing what how Shaitan got our parents, Adam and Hawa, salamun alayhima, to make the mistake that they made. What was his strategy to get them to listen to him? Not just what he said to them. We all know that he whispered to them. We all know that he offered them eternity and that they could stay in Jannah. We know that. But how did he do it? What method did he use? That method is important to understand. And it's captured in the first expression of the ayah. فَدَلَّهُمَا بِغُرُورٍ He, dalla is used when you draw a bucket. Like dalw in Arabic is a bucket. And adla is to drop a bucket down and pull it right back up. You know in the old times there's a well and you kind of crank up the water? You know, and you pull the bucket back up. This is adla. But dalla is to slowly lower the bucket or to put a bucket, you know, for a very primitive way of hunting an animal. You have some food, like a carrot or something. You put it inside a bucket and it's tied to a rope. And the animal comes and you kind of pull it little by little by little by little towards yourself. And the animal follows it. This is actually called dalla. Like literally, Shaitan didn't go out and say, disobey Allah. He offered it a little bit, just a small little bit of compromise, and they listened. And then he offered just a little bit more. It's harmless. What I'm saying isn't haram. I'm just saying, just don't take it a little bit easy, you know? And then you don't have to eat from this tree, in the case of our parents. You don't have to eat from, I'm not saying you should eat from the tree. I'm just saying, at least check it out. It's a beautiful tree. There's no harm looking at it, is there? Now, look, Allah's commandment was, وَلَا تَقْرَبَ هَذِهِ الشَّجَرَةِ Don't go near this tree. So the first thing he says, look, at least you're not touching it, okay? At least you're not touching it. Just go near it. What's the big deal? And then when they go near, then you know what? It's not like you're not supposed to climb it. You're just not supposed to eat from it. Just have a little climb. It's no big deal. And it's not at one time. Dalla also suggests that these suggestions came a day, then another day, then another day, then another day. Like this was a process for this guy. It wasn't like they did. He whispered to Adam alayhi salam and immediately he went and ate from the tree. There's actually an entire strategic, little by little by little, winning over the argument that he's doing. فَدَلَّهُمَا بِغُرُورٍ And that's what he does to us to this day. This is the reason it's mentioned in the Qur'an. That he drew them out with using this. And the بِغُرُور I didn't translate. Using deception. This is a kind of deception. In other words, there are things that are clearly wrong. You and I know that. There are things that are clearly, clearly wrong.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's
really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we come up with the solutions of your problems, questions, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Well, today to provide you with those very beautiful tips based on Quran and narrations, we have with us in the studio our guest speaker, who is a world-famous speaker and Islamic researcher. Yes, she is none other, Razia Batul Najafi. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having me here in this beautiful discussion.
Thank you so much for coming, despite your busy schedule. Sister, so today, what we are going to discuss is that in a bedtime, what we have seen in most of the societies is that children, especially the youngsters, are often used to listen to music and then they fall asleep. But what is the Islamic way of like bedtime? I would want to ask you.
Oh yeah, I love to take some lessons from the beautiful history of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha.
Yes.
And our teacher, as
our
a beautiful
model.
Mother, a role model, as a mother. Yeah, she is Ummul A'imma, the mother of A'imma alayhimus salam. So we can learn a lot from this amazing institute of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha. I love it the way she used to sing some rhymes for her children. Can
All
you
right.
believe it? You know how advanced, how modern approach she had. Like literally we have some poems which she used to rhymely recite for her children. Like she would say to Imam Hassan alayhi salam, أشبه أباك يا حسن واخلع عن الحق يا رسن. Oh my son Hassan, you are just like your father. You
All
know,
right.
you're so much familiar and resemble to your father. واخلع عن الحق يا رسن. All the obstacles which people have made to reach towards the truth and haq, just you have to remove those obstacles.
All right.
So she's encouraging them.
Providing
yeah.
strength to the children.
Yeah.
And showing that your father is a power. Like
Beautiful.
Showing the deep respect for her husband. And that too in a rhymic way.
No doubt. Because as a boys, they love to be, you know, like their father, powerful
Courageous,
and strong.
Yeah.
And one hadith we have that Jibreel, the great angel, he used to recite this lullaby for Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
All right.
And this lullaby is very famous, which
All
says,
right.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li'aliyin wa husaynin wa hasan. In Jannah, in paradise, there is a beautiful river, inna fil jannati nahran, a river of milk. This river is exclusively for Imam Hassan, Imam Ali, Imam Hussein, and Ahlul Bayt, and the lovers of Ahlul Bayt.
All right.
So look at the meanings are so profound.
Yeah.
And it shows that even about the hadith, like this is the hadith,
yeah.
but
In a rhymic way.
Exactly. I think. Yeah, we need it. I don't know why we are lacking in this area.
All right.
Nowadays, everyone loves music, rhymes, and rhythms, and tune. And, you know, these all are so beautiful techniques. But we are not using it, especially as a mother. The lullabies of mothers are very famous in every culture. So we, as a followers of the culture of Lady Fatima, we can just adopt this amazing technique of teaching of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamu Alayha.
That was such a beautiful technique. I think hardly we know about that. I would be talking to you, sister, but after a short break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about Islamic upbringing of your children in the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, sister, we're talking about the bedtime upbringing. For example, I said in many of the Western cultures, or even in many of the like Asian cultures today, we have kids, we have youngsters going to bed by listening to music. They have these headphones or headsets in their ears and they are listening to music and then they feel like they'll be going to sleep. But what actually this culture is inducing into them, don't you think that's loneliness? Because you said Lady Fatima salamu alayha used to come and give time to their children, recite rhymes for them. But what we are doing, providing headsets to our children, don't you think we are making them feel more lonely?
No doubt. And, you know, in one hand, we are taking care of them. We are showing our utmost love and care. But
spending money.
Yeah. But on the other hand, we are just demolishing and destroying their, you know, inner peace.
All
because
right.
It's something, I can say, this is a pollution, you know, like you get the polluted environment and mindset. And you can't believe it. Even scientists, they say, you are not allowed to ask your children to go to the bed with a very harsh mood.
Tune,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like if I say, go to the bed, tomorrow you have a school, it's already 10 p.m., it's too late, you have exam, you have this, so much tension, go.
So is there any Islamic way how we can teach them this?
Yeah.
Because you have been talking about beautiful Islamic ways on that note.
So Islam says the last wording which you are communicating with your child should be divine. That would be the fantastic one. Therefore, we have a chapter Mulk.
All
And I have made some rhymes that Mulki boys, Mulki girls, and how the Mulki boys, Mulki means from that Surah Mulk.
Yeah.
That how the Surah number 68.
Surah Mulk, yeah. Actually, yeah.
So inshallah, next time I'll bring my poem, which my friends have written for me, that Surah number 68 with number, we play a lot. So it shows that, okay, we have a beautiful method of sleeping in Islamic teaching, you know,
right.
like how, what should be our last thing to think and wordings to speak. So in a very polite and happy mood, we should make our children to go to their beds. That is really important. Therefore, some parents, they have a special bookshelf. Just those books they can read before going to bed. The books which give them so much, you know, peace.
Peace.
Yeah,
of
not
mind.
Horrible, you know,
horrible
novels
kind of,
and stories. Yeah,
of,
exactly.
Yeah. So parents need to definitely give time to their children. And the last thing parents say to their children before going to bed is a goodbye in a very good mood, not in a harsh tone.
And can you believe it? We have hadith that if you perform a wuzu, Yeah, so inshallah we'll talk after the break. Yeah,
yeah, of course. I am just showing that we have break. Yeah. We'll be talking after a very short break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "The best among you is he who learns the Quran and teaches it."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about Islamic upbringing issues, and sister, you're talking about bedtime upbringing.
Yeah. We as a parents, we are so lucky. We have three times. One is bedtime, one is meal time, and one is prayer time.
Wow.
So even once in a day, we can eat together, definitely. Once in a day, we can pray together, definitely. Right. And definitely we go to sleep once in a day. So at night. So these three times are really crucial, beautiful opportunities for parents, how to design, how to make them full to influence our children. So one is, I love the way Islam says, you know, the way when you want to go on your prayer mat, yeah, all to right. pray, you have to perform wuzu. The same way before going to your bed, you have to perform wuzu. Why? This is the beauty of Islam. What Islam says? Islam says that when you are performing wuzu, wuzu means a beautiful shield which gives you that protection from the whisperings of evil shaitan, and you will not have that, you know, negative attacks and confusion and all those stress.
Dilemmas.
Yeah. So I just love it. So I love the way Hadith says you can change your bed into masjid.
Wow.
Yeah, by into just performing the wuzu.
All right.
So you perform wuzu, you just sleep, you can snore, but angels are just worshiping on behalf of you. That's
right.
A beauty. Yeah.
Wow, that's so beautiful. That means we just have to perform a simple wuzu and we're turning our bed into a mosque. That was so beautiful. And you just have to sleep throughout the night. You're making angels work for you. You're making
exactly.
them do jobs for you, worship for you,
yeah.
like to make du'as for you.
That the way
so
you're
beautiful.
Talking, yeah, if a mother talk like that to her child, you know how much change she can bring, yeah? So that kind of parenting we need.
Yeah, definitely. So you said that there are some beautiful rhymes, rather, we can say to our children to wake up very early in the morning. So is there any beautiful line that you can use to, like, maybe in Arabic, maybe in English, maybe in another language, which you can tell your children to wake up early in the morning?
Yeah.
Because there's this thing, you know, we want them to wake up early in the morning. So what is the best way to tell them wake up in the morning?
Yeah. So because they want to go to the school. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not necessary to put them in pressure and say, hey, wake up. You're getting late. You just sing this beautiful hadith that talibul ilmi habibullah, talibul ilmi ruknul Islam. So you are the habib and friend of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala because you are the seeker of knowledge.
Wow.
So let's go as a talib ilm towards the school. Just back, you know, take your backpack and yeah, run for this beautiful journey.
That was so beautiful. Thank you so much, sister, for being with us. Thank you so much to your listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on the social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Until another session, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, by the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Operation Cyanide, Part 2.
Operation Cyanide. If I heard about it, I heard so.
What was it?
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it? I'm built so, and I know exactly what I'm able to tell you, and I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Cyanide?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
On June 8, 1967, news spreads around the world which wasn't easy to believe. Unknown attackers target a U.S. military ship in the Mediterranean Sea. After World War II, this was the first time someone had dared to attack the U.S. military. April 30th, 1945, when an all-out rivalry broke out between the Western Allies and the USSR to conquer Berlin, soldiers of the Red Army reached the heart of Nazi Germany sooner than the Americans. With the fall of the city and Adolf Hitler committing suicide, the flames of the horrendous Second War in Europe burnt out. The death and destruction, as World War II was coming to an end, the two powerful conquerors could raise their flags on the mountains of soil and ashes and reorganize world order the way they wanted to. The Eastern powerhouse was the USSR, which had the dream of spreading the ideals of communism and saving the masses of the labor force from the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. The USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies. When Gamal Abdel Nasser received word that Israeli forces had amassed on the Syrian border, he wasted no time. He immediately wrote to the UN and asked the organization to withdraw its peacekeeping forces, which had been stationed on the border of the neighboring countries from the previous war between Egypt and Israel. Nasser wanted to fill up the entire border Egypt had with this unwanted neighbor with his own military forces. Thank you. It seemed the Soviets' plot for a war between the ideologies of the East and the West in the Middle East had really worked. Nasser took a further step that putting his forces on standby and shut down the strategic straits of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba. The straits of Tiran were the only waterway access Israel had with the eastern part of the world. The only passageway for the Israelis to import fuel had been shut down to the Zionists, and with this, war